In 1954, the Supreme Court decided in the Brown versus Board of Education case that separate could not be equal and that schools across the country could not segregate students based on race.
It took decades after the ruling to see significant changes, but schools in the South did eventually set out to purposefully desegregate public education. Separate white and black high schools in some cases were closed and reopened as integrated schools.
Reports in recent years have shown that integration had a clear positive impact on increasing racial equality and closing the school achievement gap.
A new report out by ProPublica, however, shows that American schools, particularly in the South, are resegregating. Today in states like Alabama, a quarter of all black students attend white schools where 1% or less of the student body is white.
Here with us to discuss her report in ProPublica is reporter Nicole Hannah Jones. Nicole, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So how racially segregated were American schools before Brown versus Board of Education? If you could just give us a bit of a historical context here.
Okay. Well, in the South, of course, it was complete segregation. By law, there were no black kids except maybe small numbers in Louisiana attending schools with white children at all. In other parts of the country, there was also very high segregation, particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest, though it was often by policy and not by law. But never in the history of our country have half of black students attended schools that were majority white, even though the black population of this country has usually always hovered around about 13%.
Mm-hmm. And segregation, talk about how it was enforced and then conversely how desegregation was enforced for a while.
Well, I mean, again, in the South, it was the law. So mm-hmm. it was enforced the way that any law was enforced. But also there was a very strict racial caste, and black parents were not attempting to cross it when it came to schools down there. But what happens after Brown is really for the first 10 years in the South, there was very little enforcement of the mandate to integrate the schools. Then we see the passage of the 64 Civil Rights Act, and that's really when you start to see real desegregation coming, because for the first time, the federal government could actually sue school districts and enforce Brown that way. And because of these court orders, in a very short period of time, you go from 1963, where just 2% of black children in the South were attending school with white kids, to in the early 70s, where 90% of black kids were attending schools that at least had some white children. So that is a huge difference in a very short period of time.
What was that first statistic?
In 1963, 2% of black children in the South were attending schools with white children.
And in your report, you look specifically at Central High School in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. How did desegregation take place there?
So Tuscaloosa had first been placed under a desegregation order in 1969, but like many districts in the South, it went to kind of a neighborhood schools or freedom of choice plan. And, of course, the neighborhood school attendance zones were generally drawn in ways that maintained segregation. So in 1979, Tuscaloosa's two high schools were still pretty much segregated. There was an almost entirely black high school and a predominantly white high school, and a federal court ordered the merger of those two high schools into one, and that high school became Central. So if you were a public high school student in Tuscaloosa, you all went to the same school. So in that way, it was perfectly integrated.
And that high school has a significant place in history as it pertains to this. Talk a little bit about that and why you chose to focus on that school.
So you hear a lot about kind of the horrors of integration, but Tuscaloosa managed to make it work. This high school became the second largest high school in the state, and it quickly became a powerhouse, and it became a powerhouse athletically, but also academically. It was winning statewide math competitions. It had lots of national merit scholarships. It had award-winning debate teams. So they really managed to create a high school that academically was a success story, and that allowed the children in the community to really focus their unity around one school.
And how did they do that exactly? I mean, could you connect the dots for us on how desegregation had a direct relationship with these successes?
Well, because before, the schools were separate, and as we know in the history of this country, separate has never been made equal. So prior to that, the white school was a larger school. It had better facilities. It had a more rigorous curriculum. It had better textbooks. And the black school, while it was a source of community pride, did not have the extent of these things. So bringing all of these schools together, it actually helped both white and black students, because when you have a large high school, you're simply able to offer more because all of the resources, instead of being split, are now going into one school. So this school was able to offer a wide array of classes. They had all of the best teachers because all the teachers were at one school. So it ended up being really a powerhouse because instead of the resources being divided, they were combined. But also the loyalties of a community were not attached to two separate high schools. They were all attached to one school because everyone's mm-hmm. kid was at the same place.
And yet, if we fast forward the clock a little bit to the year 2000, you say that it seems to be reversing in a way, and that in Tuscaloosa today, nearly one in three black students that attends a school, it looks as if Brown versus Board of Education never happened. Explain that.
Well, it would be wrong to say that desegregation was easy and that there weren't casualties. And one of the casualties in Tuscaloosa was a lot of white parents pulled out of the Tuscaloosa city schools. And so the city schools went from a majority white system to a majority black system. And city leaders were concerned that the system would eventually turn all black and that that would be a detriment to the community. So in 1998, they asked to be released from their federal court order, which then would free them up to run the district however they wanted to. And they were released and almost immediately split Central into three high schools, one of which they drew the attendance line so that it would be all black.
And you refer to the term apartheid schools. What does that mean?
So apartheid schools is a term that some academics use to describe schools that are 1% or less white. And in Tuscaloosa, they created an all-black feeder system so that for a third of students in the city from kindergarten to graduation, they can never have a white classmate. Those schools are all between 99 and 100% black.
I'm curious if maybe it's too soon to tell, but perhaps not. You point to some of the academic successes that came after the integration of Central High School in Tuscaloosa. Have you seen any reports now on these achievements or not as the school starts to segregate once again?
Absolutely. So nationally, integration peaked in 1988, and the achievement gap across the country had been narrowing to that point. And after integration peaks, the achievement gap widened, and it's remained wide. We have not been able to really shrink the gap. And in Tuscaloosa, what has happened is that feeder system of all black schools have been low performing. Many of the schools have been labeled failing schools. And so you're seeing kind of the same thing. And what's been shown is those schools are not getting the most experienced teachers, are not getting the same rigorous curriculum. And so those kids are really, overall, they show that kids who attend segregated schools by the time they enter high school are 3 years behind.
We're speaking with Nicole Hannah-Jones of ProPublica about her new report that some American schools are resegregating through gerrymandering and white flight.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're back with Nicole Hannah-Jones of ProPublica, and we're talking about her new report that some American schools are resegregating.
And we'd like to hear from you. Are you familiar with schools that have homogenous populations, maybe that didn't used to in the past? And why do you think it seems to be happening all over again? Do you see this trend happening in Wisconsin, maybe at a school that is near where you live? Why do you think it's happening? 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Nicole, we have been talking a lot about Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and their Central High School, since that's the focal point of your study. But I did want to ask whether or not this is an issue that's specific to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, or the South, or is it a nationwide issue?
Oh, it's definitely a nationwide issue, and I think I want to make clear to your listeners, the focus on the South was because the South actually did go through a lot of integration, and it became the most integrated region of the country. Mm-hmm. But that other parts of the country, particularly the Midwest, where your listeners are, and the Northeast, they've never really undergone extensive desegregation. And those are actually the two most segregated regions of the country for black students.
We have a caller on the line. Marianne in Waukesha is with us. Hi, Marianne.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I know in many urban schools that behavior issues are a huge problem, and the teacher spends, you know, much of the time that he or she could be teaching trying to get the students under control. And I think many parents are very uncomfortable with that and pull their children out of public school and put them in parochial, not because of religious instruction, but because they don't want them exposed to these behavior issues and actually maybe learning that type of behavior.
And, okay, Nicole, what's your reaction to that? Is that a factor here in what's driving this resegregation of our schools?
I think the perception that these schools are somehow dangerous or that there are behavior problems definitely drives it. And I'm sure that there are behavior problems in public schools, just like there are behavior problems in any schools. And when you have kids, I mean, that's the point of public schools, is kids from all different backgrounds and parts of your area are going to attend the schools. But I think that a lot of times there is a perception problem that is a lot greater than the reality. For instance, in Tuscaloosa, with Central High School, the perception is that this is a violent, dangerous school. But I spent weeks in that school, and it was a very orderly school. And it was a very orderly school with kids who, even though they were behind, were very eager to learn. So I think we're never going to see schools where there are no issues, but we don't have a world where there are no issues. And public schools prepare your students to live in the real world.
Your study on the resegregation of the Tuscaloosa school says, you say that it's a story of the city's financial interests, secret meetings, and angry public votes. And I'm wondering if we can dig into all three of those one at a time here, starting with the city's financial interests.
So there were really two things. There was a lot of concern among city officials that if the white population in the schools declined, then white residents would also want to start leaving the city as well and go to other areas where they trusted the schools. So there was that concern because, of course, that erodes your tax base. And then there was also the concern about Tuscaloosa had been trying to attract an automobile plant, and they'd lost the Saturn plant, and they believe that they lost the Saturn plant because of the schools. And so a few years later, Mercedes was looking to build a plant there, and city officials and business leaders were determined that they were not going to lose the plant because of the schools again. And that was part of the effort to create a pocket of schools where white children would be in the majority to be able to then sell to Mercedes executives. At least that's what the people that I interviewed said, that these are schools that would be attractive to people working at Mercedes.
And these things were all just kind of being arranged in secret meetings?
Absolutely. So part of what my reporting showed was that there were a bunch of kind of behind-the-scenes meetings with very specifically invited elite, both black and white, to kind of plan this process and to strategize. And so the decisions to split apart the school were largely made in private and were made before the public was aware that this is what the district planned to do.
And explain the public's role in this. I mentioned, quote, angry public votes. How does that factor in here?
Well, because the committee was very torn over the decision to split apart Central. One, the school had only been around for a generation. It had taken a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to create Central, and it was indeed a powerhouse. So you had, of course, black parents afraid of what would happen once the school was split apart and would once again their children be neglected. And there were white parents who, some of them who really wanted to see the school split apart, and others who felt that this school had provided a great education for their kids and for the community, and who also didn't want to see it split apart. And so it came down to a divided vote that mostly went down racial lines. You had students and teachers who were opposed to the district voting to break up the school, and there was a sense that school officials had already made up their minds and did not want to listen to the public.
And you mentioned that to some extent black elites have helped resegregate the schools. How so?
Well, in Tuscaloosa, the White Elite definitely understood that in this county, in order to convince a judge to release it from its desegregation order, it needed to show that the Black community was behind it. So they held a lot of these secret meetings with kind of a select group of Black elite who supported the district, and who supported the district in exchange of getting new schools built in the Black part of town. And I think the reasons why are complex. I think a lot of Black leadership had kind of become disgruntled with integration. They felt that Black children had borne the brunt of it, that it was Black children who were on the buses for hours a day. It was Black children who often they felt were segregated once they got into the schools by being tracked into kind of lower academic classes. And so they supported because there was some fatigue, and there was also a sense of inevitability that whether Black leaders supported the district's efforts or not, it was going to happen. So at least this way they could get some leverage.
Well, I have to ask what the school administrators think of all of this and whether they're concerned about the effects of resegregating the school. What's happening there?
Well, to be fair, all of this happened, you know, 14, 15, 16 years ago. So much of the leadership in the Tuscaloosa schools now are not the people who made these decisions back then. They just have to deal with the decisions. But these are complicated issues. You don't want a school system that is entirely Black. You do want to keep your white and middle class families invested in the schools. And how do you do that? So I think there's definitely a lot of conversations going on about it. There is a commitment. One of the things that the new superintendent did was start to ensure that some of the inequities in terms of course offering that Central didn't have physics for 10 years. It didn't have advanced placement courses. Those have been remedied. But I think there's still a lot of denial as well.
What do you think that people could learn from looking at Tuscaloosa Central High School as a case study in terms of lessons to take away for our hometown school districts?
Well, I think we need people should understand that these are all children, and I really focus on a young lady named Alicia Dent, who has done everything that we tell kids that they need to do if they want to be successful. She's the class president. She's the homecoming queen. She's a award-winning athlete. She's been an honor student since sixth grade, and she's behind her counterparts. And when she's taken the ACT three times trying to get a score good enough to get into a four-year college, that's not her fault. That's the fault of the schooling that she's received. And I think we need to understand that these schools remain unequal, and that's not fair.
Mm. Well, how do you intend to follow up this story? What's next for you?
Well, I'm definitely interested in heading north, north of the Mason-Dixon line, because, as I said, there is a great deal of segregation up there, and I've told the story of the South, and now I want to look into what's happening in the North.
Nicole, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Nicole Hannah-Jones of ProPublica about her new report that some American schools are resegregating.